Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Jackie Lydon. This is The Connection. The story has spilled out in various bits and pieces out of a remote village in Pakistan and shocked much of the world. Just over a month ago, a young woman from the Punjab province was ordered by a local tribal council to be gang raped, dragged into a hut, assaulted, and made to walk home in front of hundreds of onlookers naked. Members of the council and the perpetrators are on trial, but most incidents like this, this one perhaps being more extreme than others, will never see the light of day. In countless cultures where chastity is required, silence is endemic. Women who file claims of rape are commonly ostracized by the community or charged with adultery. Worse, a woman who complains may be stoned, burned, or beheaded, sometimes by members of her own family under the auspice of honor and protected by tradition. Connection listeners, where do you draw the line between respecting culture and calling for basic human rights? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me today from New York City is Adrienne Germain, president of the International Women's Health Coalition, and from Lahore, Pakistan, Asma Jahangir, leading lawyer and women's rights advocate in Pakistan and founder, along with her sister, Hina Jalani, of the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan. Welcome to both of you.
Well, thank you.
And Adrienne, we have you there too? Asma Jahangir, let's go to you first. You're calling us from Lahore. Would you tell us, we just mentioned that some of the perpetrators in this crime of gang rape and some of the members of the tribal council who judged that this should be the penalty against the alleged crimes of this young woman are now on trial. Bring us up to speed. What is happening in that trial right now?
Well, the trial is taking place, and there has been a statement made by the victim woman's family and herself. And it's quite horrifying when her uncle comes and says that the courts or the jirga that was there actually tricked him into bringing this woman and then took her into a room. And the next thing he discovers is that she's been gang raped.
So basically they are eliciting testimony from her family members, and it seems that her family is being very supportive.
Yes, the family has been supportive, and I think everybody around has also been supportive of her, the bar associations there, the press who broke the news.
What has the character, have we heard yet from the defendants in this trial?
Well, there can be no defense, except that some of them say that this was a kind of a revenge that they took.
But I'm saying their testimony will be taken. They will have a chance to speak for themselves, or their lawyer will.
Sorry, say that again?
They will be allowed to speak. We will hear from those who are accused.
Of course we will. They will have to put up an official defense. This is an unofficial defense which has been appearing in the press.
I see. Asma Jahangir, I know that this must be at the extreme end of things that can happen in the tribal council. The word, I think, in Pakistan is it Panchayat? These tribal councils, but women now seem to be coming forward with a number of complaints of rape and of abuse. Do you see this as having sort of taken the lid off of what had been suppressed in terms of traditional culture in Pakistan?
Well, let me simply explain to you that every now and then, say every 2 or 3 years, an incident of this nature of a different circumstances, but extreme as this nature comes up in Pakistan, and the tribal customs and the tribal judiciary is involved in it. The government, you know, sort of takes interest in it and then loses interest. And this is our worry as civil society, that it does empower women in the sense it gives them encouragement to come up, but then they find that there is no relief.
In other words, the attackers are not sent to jail. Nobody pays.
Well, the attackers in one case may be sent to jail, but it encourages other women to speak up. And when they do, they find that the entire system here, the legal system, the prosecutorial system, the administration here is so gender biased that they don't get justice. So there is a kind of a frustration amongst women.
Adrienne Germain, you're president of the International Women's Health Coalition. Would you speak to your frustrations at trying to do what you perhaps can in a case like this one, which obviously beneath the surface have a number of complex issues? Is there something that an outsider, if that's what one wants to call an NGO like yours, can do?
There are several things that outsiders do. Generally hand in hand with people in the country itself. I think most importantly, though, is for your listeners to understand that as extreme as the situation is in this instance in Pakistan, and as Asma says, happens every 2 to 3 years, there are day in and day out abuses against women across the world of this sort. And they are equally vicious. They are certainly contrary to any sense of modern human rights and social justice. So I think together what is remarkable in the 30 years that I've worked on these issues is the building up of the voices of women from the community up to the national and also the international level as a matter of protest. But the bottom line is, as Asma says, that we now have increasing recognition, the action to prevent these kinds of abuses of women's human rights are still very limited by those who have the most power, namely national governments and local level governments.
Asma Jahangir, you have been fighting this battle for modern human rights in Pakistan for many, many years. And let's remember that in this particular case, not only was this woman raped, but her younger brother was sodomized. So he, too, this isn't only about women's rights, but also about those who are weaker being suppressed by those who are stronger. What would you welcome in terms of effective measures by groups such as Adrienne's in terms of looking at these issues, of trying to bring justice into modernity?
Well, I agree, because what is our opposition to our government is that they are never addressing the underlying problems. And that is that once governance begins to break, law and order situation begins to break, although there is gender bias in society, but with that included, the most vulnerable gets hit the worst. And I think that women's rights issue and the rights of marginalized people has to be connected with the political system of our country. And we have seen a lot of ad hocism in terms of governance, in terms of the whole political system in Pakistan. And it has given rise to people who have self-styled themselves as people's guarantors and taken on for themselves the mantle of trying to decide people's lives, which the government has ignored and therefore patronized in a way by their ignoring them completely and empowered them.
Adrienne Germain, isn't this a system of, say, rural justice that has worked for decades, for centuries around the world, not just in places like Pakistan? I'm thinking of a case in Mexico that came to light recently in which in a village the elders decided that a murderer should be buried alive. No question that he had committed the murder, but one could say the penalty was as horrific as the act. Is there a way to address in throughout the Third World what had been, I think, when things were only agrarian, perhaps, have they gotten tainted somehow? Have they become more vengeful, more barbaric than perhaps in times past?
I honestly can't answer that question directly, and I think what's important to look at is the contemporary situation rather than what is it more or is it less. And these community-based judicial systems, which also exist across sub-Saharan Africa, throughout Latin America, and virtually every country in which I've worked over 30 years, and the challenge here is, as you said, actually, in your title for this program, modernizing justice systems to bring together the whole momentum of globalization that the world is experiencing, together with the recognition that all countries who are members of the United Nations have made of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. In that context, then, to bring along these local judicial systems to understand that whatever the forms of justice they might have meted out in the past, whether just or not just, they are not any longer in conformity with universal human rights, and they need to have training, they need to hear the voices of the community, and they need to be both trained and brought along, or if not, then punished by the civil law authorities recognition.
But how do you do that? I'd be curious, having been in a lot of these kinds of places myself and work with people there and do it in a way, not to put too fine a point on it, so that one doesn't appear to be, the privileged member of society in New York, the white woman coming to the village and telling people how to do things.
Mm-hmm. Well, in my case, throughout my own professional work, my role has been to support people who are working in their own countries, to help them build up their leadership, build up their organizational skills and capacity to undertake work themselves. And what we've seen since 1970, when I first started this work, is an enormous blossoming of women's leadership, which now has a second and third generation working in all of these countries from the rural level right up to the city. Much of this movement is entirely, shall we say, locally grown, coming from, a basic sense of decency and social justice. In terms of the early leadership, it often was from the educated elite, for example, in India. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Gandhi set up a national commission on women's situation in 1972, and she brought into that commission primarily a leading lawyer, a major social science researcher, etc., coming from a very elite class. Who actually, I knew those members and worked with them very, very closely after they did their study, in fact. But I learned from them what had happened to them, and that was that they were mandated to go down to the village level, talk to women, talk to men, understand what was going on. And they learned that in their own country, these kinds of abuses, added to it by forced child marriages and many other kinds of practices that they knew nothing about in their own country. And as a commission, they brought out a report which was truly stunning in 1973, documenting these abuses, but saying, as the elite women's leadership at that time, we have learned of abuses we never knew existed. And they went on then to recommend revisions in the law, etc.
Okay.
Over time, non-governmental organizations grew up, some with the leadership from these individual commission members, but many more across the country, who came out of a heritage, in fact, in many parts of India, of doing good work in the community.
Okay.
Many came out of the Gandhian
movement.
Adrian,
we're going to have to go to the end of this particular segment, but we want to ask you listeners what your ideas would be about what we might call modernizing justice, bringing what we would all consider to be humane to distant and rural places, but also leaving local respect intact. If you have an idea, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation on The Connection. I'm Jackie Lydon, sitting in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection. We're talking in this hour about customs and justice and whether the two can be reconciled in places like Pakistan, Mexico, using as a specific example the case of a young woman in Pakistan who was gang raped at the behest of a local council. Both the attackers and the people who passed that judgment are now on trial in Pakistan. Let's go to the press attaché for the Pakistan Embassy in Washington and speak to Asad Hiyauddin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Would you tell us your view of these tribal councils and whether they have been in times past effective, and what the effect on the on this form of justice might now be, given that this trial has been covered all around the world?
Well, the panchayat is actually an informal traditional dispute resolution mechanism. It's been tried and tested for centuries in our part of the world. And unfortunately, this act was an aberration of the role of the panchayat. It's almost like any tool that you have. If you misuse it, that doesn't make the tool per se evil. In this case, it was a tragedy and a travesty that the dignity of a human being, two human beings, was violated.
And the younger panchayat brother as such, well. Mm-hmm.
The panchayat itself is a very inexpensive local way of dispensing justice, rather than people, poor people, going to courts, hiring lawyers, and then not knowing the language of the courts, depending on strangers to represent their cases, have the option of going to their own village elders and resolving their disputes in-house without any cost, without any lawyers, without any intermediation. Now, that is the spirit of the panchayat, but that certainly does not condone what they did in this case.
Mm-hmm. But for so many women, especially, and there is also a young boy here, for every case in which the panchayat undoubtedly resolved, say, a land dispute or some sort of other issue successfully, one does hear numerous cases in which something, perhaps not as extreme as this, but in which something has gone terribly wrong.
I think this is the only case where a panchayat was used or used itself to settle some sort of a score which resulted in this horrendous act. Now, that is being rectified. I don't see the government trying to disband panchayats. They have a role, they have had a role in society, and they will have a role as long as 70% of our people are in rural areas and with a 40% literacy rate.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reality. That's the environment. And within that environment, I think doing away with the panchayats is not the solution to the problem.
No, I wasn't suggesting that doing away with them is, but I would be interested from hearing from Asma and Adrian what you think might be done. Asma, does the panchayat, do you think, have a role to play? And what do you think the effect of the trial is going to be on the custom of panchayat?
Well, first of all, let me just correct my friend from Washington. This is not the first time that a panchayat has given a verdict like this. These systems have been misused for centuries against vulnerable people, and women have received nothing but injustice through panchayat. And the second thing is that you cannot privatize criminal legal system, and it is the system of impunity, either through government patronage to this panchayat or by the government itself, that in fact does brutalize society as such, and this is what has precisely what has happened there and precisely what happened in Mexico. I don't think anybody has a right to give impunity for criminal acts being done, and I would say fine panchayats for civil litigation, but it is unacceptable that there can be a panchayat for criminal litigation. And I have to this day come to see a panchayat order which has been based on justice for somebody who has come from a more marginalized section of society. In the last, say, 10 years, I can recount at least 20 incidents where the panchayats have given very brutalized judgments against women. In one case, it was, in fact, of cutting off her ears. So I am afraid that the gentleman doesn't know his facts as well.
Is there a way to send these cases in a country like Pakistan to the city where the courts would be available? Might not that be one solution, bridging a resource-poor area with one that at least had some more civil resources?
No, excuse me. There are courts even at the local level, and there is police at the local level. Can you imagine that the administration stood there and watched all this happen and only reacted after there was an outrage? Of course, the question always remains that we cannot say that we will not strengthen our judicial system and let these self-styled panchayats take over the country. Then what is the role of the governments in this country? Then if they are privatizing justice system as well, they may as well just privatize the whole country then.
Asad, I think that question does come to you. Is there a way to make civil authority there stronger, less susceptible to bribes, or less susceptible to bad decisions?
I would say that it's not as if there's Panchayat Raj or Panchayat Rule running amok. These are basically small claims courts on an informal basis. They do not dispense justice in terms of what we would call crimes involving moral turpitude. For that, you have a court system. And Ms. Jahangir, being a lawyer, is aware of the court system and the shortfalls of it, like in any third world system. Pakistan does not have a monopoly on misogynistic behavior or practices. It is an unfortunate part of our society, and we are trying to rectify it. I'd just like to give you a brief rundown on what has been tried to rectify centuries of discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
33% of seats have been reserved for women. Now, whether those seats will be filled in the next elections is a separate issue, but at least for the first time, a step has been taken to try to empower women at the local level. Now, whether they run or their husbands prevent them from running, that's a societal attitudinal issue. Legally, the government has reserved seats for them.
Are you talking about at local councils?
At local bodies, yeah, local bodies, local councils. Similarly, 66 seats have been reserved in the National Assembly for women. And prior to that, women's police stations have been established to be staffed by women. And an additional step was taken to encourage more women, or at least try to bring more women into the judiciary. Now, I know these are evolutionary methods, but at least a start has been made. And I certainly can't say that overnight we'll have a revolution in which centuries of misogynistic practices will be eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
But we all have to start somewhere.
Adrian,
and I think a start has been made.
Okay. Adrian Germain, would you say that this is a step in the right direction?
I think all of the steps are helpful. And the point here is that we need multiple levels of recognition and multiple levels of action. In Bangladesh, for example, the local courts are called shalishas, and they have also never given out justice to women, as Asma described in regard to Pakistan. But what some of the community-based development organizations have been doing as they work to mobilize landless people who are the most disadvantaged and vulnerable in the Bangladesh side is to bring women into their community development efforts and mobilize communities to respect and understand women's rights. And in the course of doing that, in some cases, they have been able to work with the shalishas to train their members and reorient them in regard to how they handle, conflict at the village level. I think the difficult dilemma that we are facing, and I happen to have done much more local level work in Bangladesh, certainly, than I have in Pakistan. So I'm just talking about the Bangladesh
situation. Well, I think broadening this beyond one country is important, although obviously Pakistan gives us an example.
No, but I want to say that there's a difference between the Salish system and the Panchayat system here.
Okay, between Bangladesh and Pakistan.
It is recognized at least through some instrument of the law. Now, these Panchayats have no legal sanctity at all. They are not set up by the government. They just create themselves, and the government sort of does not take any action against them. They have no legitimacy, either by law or through elections of the people.
Mm-hmm.
Asad Hiyal-Uddin, do you think that the government needs to be clearer about saying something to the panchayats about how far they should go, whether they should perhaps be involved in criminal cases at all and perhaps confine matters to just civil disputes, property disputes, that sort of thing?
In the British, before 1947, the British had a panchayat law that governed panchayats, and basically they were small claims courts. I think as an informal dispute resolution mechanism, they should be restricted to small claims like, water disputes, minor land disputes. The state cannot privatize its right of dealing with criminal administration of justice. That should rest squarely with the state. But I think, yes, in order to save costs and localize disputes, certain types of disputes, purely civil disputes, should be relegated to the panchayats.
All right. Let's take some callers from our listeners. We're talking at the connection, 1-800-423-8255. We're talking to David. Hello.
Hello. This is a very serious and disturbing subject, the punishment of women by sexual humiliation. And it's everything you've been saying so far is very important to get out and to do something about it. I just wanted to correct the impression that this is something that only happens in some remote region of some remote Asian country. I've seen the photographs, and I think you probably have too, of the women in France after World War II who were accused of consorting with Nazis. Their hair was shaven off, and they were forced to walk naked through their towns. And I believe this is something that we all have in us, and I think it's important to remember that as we try to prescribe what people in Pakistan ought to do.
Okay. Thank you very much for that, David. Asma Jahangir, we were just talking about perhaps limiting, having the Pakistan national government say to the panchayats, look, you only get to decide minor disputes. Would that help?
Well, you know, we are talking at cross purposes, because these panchayats that I am talking about, the government has nothing to do with it.
But if the government were to...
The judgment was not given by a panchayat set up by the government at all. I think what the government needs to do is to take action about self-styled people who take it upon themselves to give these decisions and give these decisions against vulnerable sections. And this is not the only decision. I can recount at least 12 decisions that I have seen in the last 5 years where there were horrific punishments given to women on charges of immorality.
Mm-hmm. The analogy might be drawn to the notion, instead of justice, of the lynch mob, which comes straight from, you know, a sort of action that at the time people, you know, felt that they were going to take vigilantism into their own hands. Are you worried in any sense, Asad Hiyauddin, that these things are becoming basically vigilantism?
Well, that's what it is, basically. That I think the panchayat label has been misused here. It's people who decided, if the sequence of events is correct, that they tried to rectify one wrong, which was the rape of the brother, by doing another wrong, which was to rape the sister. That is abominable. I mean, the punishment, they're being tried in an anti-terrorist court, which means that probably they'll get the death sentence if convicted. So that should show you the sincerity and the severity of justice in this case. And yes, lynch justice...
But I think it was her own brother that was actually sexually abused. So it was the brother and the sister, both. So the brother was first sexually abused, and then the sister was raped.
That's what I'm saying. So they tried to rectify one wrong by doing another wrong so they could cover their tracks. They accused the brother of being with a woman of a higher caste. Mm-hmm. So this act certainly deserves the most severe and stringent punishment to set an example.
If the judges rule, Asma, that the death penalty should be the result here, what kind of a message will that send? Do you think that will chill other abuses or not?
Well, in the first place, I am not for death penalty in a system like ours, where the government comes and says this man should be given death penalty, and people then lose trust in the court system. But however they should be punished, I think it will give a message momentarily, but the government does not sustain their effort and does not address the underlying causes. This is my whole point, is that it is the underlying causes that have to be addressed. Of course, one case at a time should be looked at, but also look at what is happening. Now, for example, in our country, a murder can be forgiven by the people, by the family of the deceased. And a lot of women are getting killed. Why? Because it's the family that kills them, and it's the family that forgives each other.
So you're saying that even if women were to avail themselves of the court system, even if there were a court that this woman could have gone to, I presume, or any woman who's been assaulted, her family might then attack her for raising her head up enough to complain.
No, well, in this case, if she went to the court and said, I have been raped, the court, the police first would have seen whether she consented to the act or not, because that's the law. And so they would have arrested her. They could have arrested her. So what I'm saying is that the legislation is very much heavily oppressive, persecuting women. That has to be changed, for God's sake.
All right. Let's go to another call. Rafad is calling from Boston.
For taking my call. As a Muslim, but I'm not Pakistani, first of all, I want to say that I'm ashamed and really disgusted with what happened in Pakistan. I heard about this story a long time ago. I didn't believe it. This happened in a Muslim country. But unfortunately, because of the misrepresentation of so-called, they're supposed to have an Islamic law in Pakistan, but they are not applying nothing of it. And I think that the government of Pakistan should eliminate this kind of tribal councillor there because they are harming the people, not benefiting anybody, and replacing a law like a modern law with other law. I think in the Muslim countries, if they want really, as Pakistan, they claim that they want to apply Islamic and the Sharia, which they are not actually, mm-hmm. because the Sharia, I'm aware of the Sharia and what the Sharia said in different cases. This case, the punishment is not by killing, is not by raping, is not by any of that thing what they are being done. I hear that the boy was walking with the girl.
Okay. Let's turn this and give Mr. Hayauddin enough time. Do you think that the time has come, Mr. Hayauddin, to say that the tribal council system has been miscarried and that will this verdict send a message? Is that enough? Or does the government of Pakistan need to get aggressive, do more, and think about ending panchayat altogether?
Well, there is no panchayat ordinance or law that governs these things.
I understand that. Maybe that's the problem.
Maybe they should have a law that governs them, because in the times of the British, there was a panchayat system. There was a panchayat ordinance that governed panchayats in villages. It's an issue of the modernizing imperative versus tradition. If a tradition is bad or it violates the dignity of human beings, then, of course, it should be done away with. But if we can temper it, I think the government should take some step, but that's a legal issue. I think the legal experts would adjudicate upon that. And just for a brief aside to this, there is nothing in the Quran or in Islam that says that women are inferior to men. It's unfortunately interpretation and misinterpretation of Quran and quoting a hadith out of context that has led some people to assume that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll come back to examining what Pakistan should do, how to modernize justice when we come back. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From all.
I'm Jackie Lydon. This is The Connection. And we've been talking in this hour about tribal justice and trying to modernize that system in some way that would be more effective for those people who have suffered beyond the reaches of the law, using the case that happened recently in Pakistan of the gang rape of a young woman there. Our guests today are Asma Jahangir, who's a prominent lawyer and women's rights advocate in Pakistan, and Asad Hayauddin, the press attaché for the Pakistan Embassy in Washington, and Adrian Germain, who's president of the International Women's Health Coalition. Adrian, obviously there is a need for more equity in a lot of these places, but there is also, I think, a certain squeamishness on the part of outsiders, on the part of NGOs, and even the educated classes, shall we say, in these places about coming into a rural village and telling people how to live, what to do, and how to address the underlying causes that result in these things. We're talking about places with terrible poverty, very little education, huge illiteracy. So where do you begin to try to balance the equation so that justice might be brought in for all?
I think that, as I said earlier, we need efforts on multiple fronts. It would be instructive, perhaps, for us to look at what has been done to try to end female genital mutilation across sub-Saharan Africa and in certain other countries, such as Egypt. Some countries have made a lot of progress, others have not. And what you've had is that when I first became involved in the early 70s, there was an outcry from American activists, one or two, who called the custom barbaric and who, if anything, hardened resistance to changing those customs in countries like Sudan. Mm-hmm. And gradually over the years, however, women and men in in the Sudan, in Western Africa, and all across Eastern and Southern Africa, where this is so prevalent, began to speak out. They realized their daughters were dying. And at the same time, the international women's health and rights communities brought up the issue at the World Conference on Human Rights, which finally, for the first time, recognized that women's rights are human rights, and nobody has a right to violate the physical integrity of the person in the way that FGM, female genital mutilation, does. Then a few years later, the World Health Assembly, which is the ministers of health from all the world's countries, passed a resolution saying that as a health matter, this could not and should not continue. So what you have is an interaction between the local level activists working from the community up, and then the endorsement, if you like, the reflection from the international community, which actually is the world's governments in these UN agencies, then working back down into the countries, such that now, I'm not up to date on the exact facts, but I think it may be as many as 20 sub-Saharan African countries have passed laws against female genital mutilation. But passing a law isn't enough. You still need to invest substantially, both locally and then from outside. Often funding is needed for these non-government groups who actually work at the community level, figure out strategies that, that the community will accept and work with.
And you have that to just get beyond the squeamishness, Adrian, and maybe not use loaded words like barbaric, but say, you know, this isn't right. You just have to change it. You have to stop it.
Yes, because as I mentioned, in order to be a member of the United Nations, a country must endorse the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Which would say, of course, that rape is a crime among humans.
Well,
they
are the most fundamental rights, and you have a right to life, you have a right to dignity, you have a right to bodily integrity, et cetera, non-discrimination, and so on. So any country that joins the UN says, yes, we will uphold these human rights. Now, working that through the system, as we've discussed this morning, has all of its challenges in a country like Pakistan. But it's important, I think, for your audience to know that it requires multiple efforts at multiple levels and a solidarity and a commitment that these kinds of practices need attention and will be changed. And the role of the outsider often is, as I tried to say earlier, to be responsive and supportive to the local voices that are saying this must stop in our society. Sometimes they may request assistance to fully understand what are the international human rights agreements, or sometimes they may request financial support for the activities that they are doing. Right now, frankly, many of our colleagues around the world are asking us to do something about the Bush administration, which is not at all supportive of the kinds of work that need to be done to ensure that women can fully exercise their fundamental human rights and freedoms.
All right. Well, before we open up what might be a political point, let's hear from our listeners on those we already have on the table this morning and go to Steve, who is calling from Boston.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. I just got back from a trip to Sudan and wanted just to connect the great discussion you're having in Pakistan to Sudan as well. I was there with a nonprofit group that is working to free slaves. And in the civil war that's gone on in Sudan for 19 years, the government has, as part of its ongoing campaign, the civil war has enslaved its own people. It goes into small villages, kills men, and enslaves women and children. There are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people that have been enslaved. There's an underground railroad effort with a nonprofit that American Anti-Slavery Group and others working to free slaves. And so I guess the question is a government, as part of a civil war, is slavery a basic human, you know, the right to self-determination in terms of just who owns you? And in Sudan, unfortunately, the answer is no. Even today, I came back a month ago, and we freed 1,100 slaves. And unfortunately, there are many more that still exist. And while there are peace talks going on today, the issues haven't been resolved, and there are still people enslaved there. And the government they will dodge and weave, but ultimately say that they're, quote, abductees. They're prisoners of war, and it's simple. They're slaves. They're women and children that are enslaved by their own people.
Mm-hmm. Asma Jahangir, can you draw an analogy to that and Pakistan? Is that something that is custom, that is in some way sanctioned by the government? Could the same thing be said in Pakistan, and should that be interfered with?
Well, here we do have a large number of bonded labor. It has been outlawed by the government. But as was said earlier, law is not enough. However, I would like to point out that the issue that we were talking about earlier, that talking about modernizing these panchayats is not the issue, because they are not an entity recognized by anybody, and they have simply instigated the commission of a crime.
Mm-hmm.
And what the state needs to do is to apprehend them.
But if they are recognized by the people, if that has been the custom, you said there were underlying causes in these kinds of things.
No, I'm sorry, they are not recognized by the people either. This is what you have to understand. And this notion of going to tell them what to do, for example, in this particular case, people were so outraged that they have actually named their schools after this lady, and they have named their roads after her, because they are outraged. And they have said that these are people who have, in fact, they are gangs and criminals that have stifled our voices and rule our lives, because the government will never take action against them.
Asad Hayuddin, do you think people are just going to quit recognizing the panchayat? I mean, maybe what if everybody just said, you know what, you have no authority over us?
Well, it's restricted to only one part of the country. The panchayats, there are four provinces of Pakistan. In the other provinces, there are different types of local village systems. The panchayat is basically a Punjab-related institution. So, yes, I mean, it's not a uniform phenomenon. I just mentioned it that if the government deems fit, but of course, if these things are going to get out of hand and act like lynch mobs, then there's certainly no reason to legitimize something that's going to dishonor human dignity.
Either legally or by custom. Let's go to...
No, but the government has never recognized these panchayats. I think we are talking at cross purposes, because the government has made certain panchayats, and it was not the government recognized panchayats that actually gave this verdict. It was just people who have empowered themselves, who have connections with administration, who run drugs there, who run guns there, that have actually self-styled themselves as panchayat, and they are in every province.
All right. Let's go to Haider, who is calling from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hello.
Hello, Haider.
Hi. A very interesting subject. I'm from Multan, Pakistan, originally. Haven't been back to Pakistan in the last 15 years, but I'm much aware of this issue, and I appreciate your guests. I believe the panchayat is much needed because it's deep-rooted in culture itself. So it will be extremely hard to uproot it in a short while. But it's very positive to coordinate this panchayat with the government-run institutions. So these can report to the government-run institution. And also, there's much needed education for women and the understanding of women's rights, and also delivering this to women and so they can understand what their rights are. That's much needed in Pakistan.
So you would integrate the old, if lack of a better word, the old customs with a new system. In other words, you would just have them be governed more than they are today.
Absolutely, because they're not that negative or effects. Also, there are a lot of positives, and like Asad mentioned, a lot of good things are coming. They have been doing it. You cannot just uproot, you know, one year.
Excuse me, I think that you need to read the reports here. These informal panchayat systems have not done one good thing. You will read the report, I mean, don't sit there and tell me that the government should do this, because the government has its own panchayat system, and mm-hmm. yet it is these criminal gangs crop up every now and then. They call themselves panchayat. They are basically a gang of thugs that takes people, that suffocates people, and gives a judgment in connection with the administration.
Haider?
And there has not been a single judgment of this panchayat where people have been happy. In fact, if you come and go to these areas, you will realize that people are against this panchayat system completely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yes, these panchayats in some ways have been serving the big landlords, but I truly believe there is a room
to coordinate this, and so the voice of average Pakistani can be heard on, because these people do not. Asma, you have to understand that, I mean, this is a culture, deep-rooted culture. But I don't think they need to be empowered. I think they need to be more regulated under the government and the law.
Okay, thank you, Haider. Adrian Germaine, do you think that what it might be best here is to, in fact, integrate these systems somehow so that there aren't two separate systems of justice, one that you can buy and one that's for poor people who don't have any power?
No, I'm sorry that you cannot let this get by, because we do not have a culture of raping women, and it is not a culture of Pakistan. This is a criminal act. It has nothing to do with our culture.
I would like to strongly support what Asma is saying, even though I'm an outsider to this. And what I've been trying to say by reference to the International Human Rights Agreement is that no one under any circumstances has the right to do this to a woman, period. And at the same time, I think that what we're seeing here is how much effort it will take to change the system, and that what's important for us from the outside is to be supporting the voices for human rights, like Asma's, and the work that is entailed actually to change these deep underlying kinds of conditions, which I know from more intensive work in Bangladesh is very similar. You do have lawlessness. You do have governments who aren't able to control the situations in the countryside. And one reason that the growth of civil society has been so critically important in Bangladesh or India or even now in Nigeria is so that the communities have an organized voice and they can speak up for themselves in a way that's powerful enough for the governments to hear. At the same time, in the election process, if there can be a democratic process, and as we all know, you know, Pakistan and other democracies are under threat all the time. Mm-hmm. The electorate needs enough accurate information and understanding to vote with their feet. And then the international community, through the United Nations Human Rights Commission, the special rapporteurs, including a special rapporteur on women's rights, the various international treaty agreements that governments reach together at the UN system, these also need to hold the governments accountable.
Okay, thank you, Pakistan. Adrian. Let's just let Mr. Hayyuddin, can you just very, very quickly say what might promote more civil society in Pakistan in 30 seconds or less?
Well, I would say that we've misinterpreted one thing, basically, that we're not saying what the panchayat did represented sovereign will. It was an act of rape. No matter who does it, it's against the law. So that should be clear. Number two, what essentially comes down is that the things to do list for Pakistan is land reforms, demarginalizing the weaker segments, legal reform, and a correct scholarly interpretation of Islam to delegitimize traditions. Now, that is a pretty big agenda.
I'd say
and
so.
I think that's what we need to pursue, and that's what the government is hopefully going to achieve.
I want to thank all my guests today. Adrian Germaine is president of the International Women's Health Coalition. Asma Jahangir is a leading lawyer and women's rights advocate in Pakistan and a founding member of the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan. And Asad Hayyuddin is press attaché for the Pakistan Embassy in Washington. Our senior producer here at The Connection is Graham Smith. I'm Jackie Lydon in for Dick Gordon, and you're listening to The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can do.